Thank you, Richard. Brethren and sisters, we have followed the life of the Apostle Paul through the his adventures, so to speak, in Jerusalem, and we have seen him come down into the city of Caesarea. In Acts chapter 23, which we looked at last time, the Apostle was brought before the leaders or the elders of the Jewish nation, the Sanhedrin. And whilst he started with good intentions, endeavouring to perhaps answer for the resurrection of the dead, he nonetheless saw the Sanhedrin divided amongst themselves between Pharisees and Sadducees, and the whole council came to an end in a great tumult. He also noticed or saw that the high priest was unrecognisable, and as a result of that, his face was slapped and he was rebuked. He also was set upon, or rather it was intended that he be set upon, by 40 murderous Jews who typically displayed in their attitude the mind of the nation in the 40 years from AD 30 to AD 70. And in that sense, they do, in a way, represent the nation in this attitude that they had, and they took upon themselves the curse that they would not eat nor drink until Paul was dead. Now, they failed in their resolutions and ought therefore to have suffered death by their own foolishness. But, as we pointed out last time, the Torah provided a means whereby one could absolve such a vow and not have to suffer the consequence. Now, the Apostle was evacuated from Jerusalem, and he was given a tremendous security by Lysias. He provided 200 soldiers, 200 foot spearmen, and 70 cavalry, and also, of course, the means for Paul to ride upon a beast. So that the Apostle then, although the 400 soldiers returned back halfway along the journey, yet the Apostle was conveyed into Caesarea amidst the 70 cavalry. And one can't help but think that here was a suspected criminal who was, as it were, triumphantly riding into Caesarea like a visiting dignity amongst this 70 cavalry. And so it is that the events which remained behind in Jerusalem, with the Sanhedrin divided against itself, was somewhat a pathetic sight, realising that in the theme of the Acts, as we have been following that parabolic theme, that it represents to our minds, or brings to our minds, the fate of the Jewish Commonwealth in AD 70, when the system of the law was completely removed and the nation was itself scattered. Now, in chapters 24 to 26, our theme tends to flow on, and the focus now comes upon the Apostle Paul before the Gentile rulers or heavenlies. And it brings to mind, brethren and sisters, the times of the Gentiles in which we live. The third great age, which we pointed out last time, we had the antediluvian, the Jewish age, and then the Gentile period. And the third great age was formally opened by Tertullus in the early verses of chapter 24 here, and Tertullus's name means the third. So it's just a little implication that this is the new phase of the Apostle's life in answering for the hope that was within him before the Gentiles, and also conveying to our minds this period of the Gentiles and their rulership. Now, Lysias, though he honestly and sincerely tried to reach the bottom of Paul's case, he was time and time again disappointed and frustrated in his attempts to get to the bottom of the Apostle. So that finally he was forced to commend the case into the hands of Felix, and thereby the Apostle was conducted from Jerusalem down to Caesarea. Now, in chapters 24 to 26, we have some quite lengthy defences, if you like, of the Apostle Paul, three of them. And one might wonder as to why the Acts should almost finish up with this very lengthy treatise of three defences before three rulers. And they could almost seem to be somewhat repetitious. But there are good reasons. The first of all would be, obviously, that it was a chance for the apostle and for Luke in recording to show that the truth was set forth before these Gentile rulers. But perhaps more importantly than that, as the theme of the record seems to suggest, the idea is to project forth to our minds the way in which these Gentile principalities would react to the power of the truth and to its bearer. Now, the apostle himself, in a very small way, sets forth to our minds a little cameo of the Lord Jesus Christ, who, as in the heavens now, has been given all power in heaven and upon earth, as Matthew recorded, and thereby he is the supreme one over and above all the principalities upon this earth. And we're going to see how that the Apostle Paul, though a prisoner, yet he still maintains this psychological supremacy. And each of these principalities, as they come before the apostle, are caused to feel their guilt. And they are quite relieved to see him passed on to the next. And so it is then that in verses 5 to 9, we have Tertullus formally laying the charges against the apostle Paul before Felix. And in verse 5, we have the catalogue of charges. He said, "For we have found this man a pestilent fellow, and a mover of sedition among all the Jews throughout the world, and a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, who also hath gone about to profane the temple, whom we took and would have judged according to our law. But the chief captain Lysias came upon us, and with great violence took him away out of our hands, commanding his accusers to come unto thee." Now, they were the formal charges. First of all, he was accused of being a pestilent fellow. And in the Greek, it is the same word which is used for a pestilence as far as a plague is concerned. The Lord Jesus Christ used the same word in Luke 21, verse 11, when he was talking about the signs of the times which surrounded AD 70 and the passing of the Jewish Commonwealth. He mentioned there that there would be earthquakes in divers places, and these famines and pestilences, as the word is. And it has the idea of a deadly infectious malady. Now, it would appear then that by inference, the apostle was looked upon here as a pest, but perhaps with the idea that he was a disturber who was highly dangerous, and therefore it was essential that he be dealt with. Now, he's a mover of sedition. And that phrase means that he was one who caused factions among the Jews, and Tertullus is careful to point out in verse 5, throughout the world. So it's not a local disturbance that they are concerned with, but it was a disturbance which was led of the apostle throughout the Roman Empire. And therefore Felix ought to be concerned for the matter. Thirdly, he was described as being a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes, which is a Jewish way of explaining the Christian movement. They called it a sect of the Nazarenes. He was therefore said to be the leader of the Christian movement. And fourthly, they said that he attempted to profane the temple, to treat it with contempt and disrespect. And now in verse 7, Tertullus points out how that Lysias came upon them with great violence, as if to say, well, it wasn't necessary. And because of that great violence, they were caused to bring the case down to Caesarea, clearly implying that it should never have had to been done. That Lysias, in fact, had intervened to prevent religious justice. And now Felix has got to be brought into the picture when, by implication, he shouldn't have had to. So in verse 8 then, commanding his accusers to come unto thee to tell us, by examining of whom thyself mayest take knowledge of all these things whereof we accuse him. So Felix now was going to have to examine Paul to ascertain the validity of these charges. And the Jews in verse 9 also assented, saying that these things were so. And so the case now has been formally presented. The charges in a very eloquent manner have been laid against the apostle in what we might also call a devious and deceitful way, because that's what this fellow Tertullus was. And Paul was accused of being an agitator, seditious, heretical and impious. And Felix is the man now who has to wrestle with the problem. And the spotlight is coming and focusing upon him. Now Felix, his name means happy, and by worldly standards, if he's happy, it would seem to suggest he was a licentious kind of man, for that is the means by which the world generally finds its happiness. He was originally a slave, but he was liberated by Claudius Caesar for some unknown service to the empire. Subsequently, he was appointed as procurator of Judea about AD 53. Suetonius, the historian, refers to military honours that were conferred upon him, so that possibly the service which he rendered to the empire was in a military sense. He also states that Felix had three queens, or three wives, including Drusilla. And along with that, he was noted for his extreme ruthlessness and cruelty. Now, another of the historians, Tacitus, actually quoted these words concerning Felix. He said, "In the practice of all kinds of lust and cruelty, he exercised the power of a king with the temperament of a slave." So there was a man who, though he was a king, he had the mentality and the temperament of a slave. He considered himself, brethren and sisters, as licensed to commit any crime. And having appointed Jonathan, whom we mentioned last time, as the high priest, to give you one example of the type of man he was, he appointed this Jonathan as high priest in place of Ananias, who was taken to Rome. Jonathan, conscientious in his office, then noted the very poor kind of leadership that Felix exercised, and he gave him too much advice. For Felix took exception to his criticism, and he had him assassinated. And he used the Sicarii, who were a gang of thugs, who figured quite prominently in the Jewish wars that led up to AD 70, he employed them to get rid of Jonathan. So he's quite an unprincipled and unscrupulous man. Now Felix took a fancy to Drusilla, who was the daughter of King Herod Agrippa. And she at the time was married to Azes, the king of Emesia. Now Felix, his principles of life were such that he employed Simon the magician to exercise his influence upon Drusilla in order to draw her away from her rightful husband and to take him in wedlock. So therefore, this is the kind of man that the apostle is to appear before. Felix, as we shall see a little later on, or as we read, endeavoured to extract a bribe from the apostle Paul. And of course he didn't get it. Subsequently, he was called back to Rome. In the 2 years that the apostle remained in the prison at Caesarea, there was tremendous disturbances which arose up, particularly in Caesarea, but generally too throughout the land. And there was bloodshed and violence between Jew and Gentile in Caesarea. Now Felix exercised his authority rather inappropriately and unjustly, and charges went against him to Rome, so that eventually he was called over there. He appeared before the Emperor Nero, and whilst he was acquitted of the charges, he was nonetheless banished from the pages of history into the silence of isolation. Now, Paul's defence. Well, how, brethren and sisters, would we feel to virtually stand up and answer for the hope of the truth in front of a madman? You know, if we were to try and colour that picture just in a little way, perhaps rather crude, but in a way with contemporary situation, how would we like to go to Uganda and stand trial for virtually our life or our freedom in front of their president, who would be a man who exercised about the same kind of mentality that Felix would have had? So the apostle then stands before Felix, and he does so with open manliness. There was no deceitfulness, there was no deviousness such as Tertullus exercised, but open and honest. And so, taking up the apostle's answer, he says in verse 10, Then Paul, after that the governor had beckoned unto him to speak, answered, "Forasmuch as I know that thou hast been of many years a judge to this nation, I do the more cheerfully answer for myself." So if there were any heart that the apostle could take in the situation, it was that Felix had been procurator of Judea for some time, and therefore he had come to know, brethren and sisters, that the Jews were unreliable, that the Jews were proverbial for their agitation, and therefore the charges that the apostle was answering against could well be unreliable or unfounded. So Paul took courage in that, and perhaps by a little turn of not so much cunning, but perhaps just good sense, he would have invoked the favour of Felix in that respect. So he says then in verse 11, "Because that thou mayest understand that there are yet but 12 days since I went up to Jerusalem for to worship. And they found me in the temple, disputing with any man, neither raising up the people, neither in the synagogues, nor in the city. Neither can they prove the things whereof they now accuse me." Now the apostle here, step by step, logically refutes the charges placed against him. Now first of all, he implies that the charges are probably just like the Jews, totally unfounded and unreliable. Then he goes on to say that he was in Jerusalem for only 12 days. And furthermore, he had neither been engaged in any subversive activity, and therefore, how could he be accused of causing divisions among Jewry, of disrespecting the temple, of causing riotous behaviour in Jerusalem, when he had only been there for 12 days, virtually had contact with nobody? Having established that point, in verses 14 to 16, he goes on to treat the matter of heresy. He says, "But this I confess unto thee, that after the way which they call heresy, so worship I the God of my fathers, believing all things which are written in the law and the prophets, and having hope toward God, which they themselves also allow, that there shall be a resurrection of the dead, both of the just and unjust. And herein do I exercise myself to have always a conscience void of offence toward God and toward men." Now there the apostle outlines his integrity or credibility. Here is one who had exercised himself always with a good conscience toward God and toward men. He shows that he's not in fact a heretic, that the principle of his life, rather than being heresy, was in fact conformity. It was conformity to the national hope or religion. He was honest and upright in life. He lived according to the law and to the prophets. He believed in the resurrection of the dead, which the Jews also allow, he said. So therefore, how could the charges of heresy stand against him? If the Jews allow it, how could they disagree with their own national hope in accusing the Apostle Paul? And then moving on in verses 18 to 21, He tackles the subject of sacrilege, disrespect of the temple. And so he says, "Whereupon certain Jews from Asia found me purified in the temple, neither with multitude nor with tumult, who ought to have been here before thee and object, if they had aught against me? Or else let these same here say, if they have found any evil doing in me while I stood before the council, except it be for this one voice, that I cried standing among them, touching the resurrection of the dead, I am called in question by you this day." So it was then that the apostle rebutted the charge of sacrilege. When he was in Jerusalem, he pointed out that he had observed the strictest requirements of the law and in absence of tumult. So there was no resemblance of sacrilege or disrespect or blasphemy against the temple. He also points out, brethren and sisters, that the charge here brought against him was totally illegal. Because where were his accusers? They were Jews from Asia, and they were not present to lay their charges against him. So it completely dismissed the idea of sacrilege. Having done that, he now invites the Sanhedrin, those represented there of the Sanhedrin, to press their charges against him. If he has done any evil, he said, let them press their charge. But they had none. Furthermore, in verse 21, he invited them to take up the point on the resurrection of the dead, which was the very issue that led the council into utter embarrassment and total disgrace, because they were divided amongst themselves and they argued bitterly over the issue of the resurrection, the Pharisees against the Sadducees. So there would have been a few more embarrassed faces in front of Felix, and needless to say, they had no intention of taking up any such like charges against the apostle. So then he had dismissed the whole array of charges. He had shown himself, brethren and sisters, of much better eloquence and a much better, perhaps, debater, if you like, a much more logical person than this one Tertullus, who had come out in all his glory and deception to lay the charges against the apostle. Now Felix, though he had been a slave, and though we wouldn't credit him with a high degree of academic type thinking, yet Felix was able to see in his simplicity that the apostle was not guilty of those charges. So that in verse 21 we read, in verse 22 we read, and when Felix heard these things, having more perfect knowledge of that way, he deferred them and said, when Lysias the chief captain shall come down, I will know the uttermost of your matter. And he commanded a centurion to keep Paul and to let him have liberty, and that he should forbid none of his acquaintance to minister or come unto him. Now, Felix had perceived that the apostle was not guilty of the charges. However, his integrity, the personal strength of his character, was not sufficient whereby he could come out and stand up boldly, acquit Paul of his charges, and permit him his freedom. But rather, we see a man who procrastinates. And he procrastinates, brethren and sisters, because he doesn't want to invoke the disfavour of the Jews. He had enough troubles on his hands as it was. They were an agitated people, and to provoke further disfavour against him would not be to his advantage. So he did the logical thing. He procrastinated. He said, well, we'll continue with the case when Lysias comes down. Now, Lysias could do no more than what was here, because the whole thing was out of his hands, and he too was incapable of handling the case of the apostle. So then, perhaps with a certain amount of fairness, whilst he procrastinated with the Jews, he nonetheless showed some favour towards the apostle. Because, you see, he allowed him to have liberty in verse 23, and also that he should forbid none of his acquaintance to minister or come under him. Now that reads there a little confusing, but in actual fact what it is saying is that that Felix had commanded the centurion that he was to allow Paul's friends to come and minister unto him. Now you'll find that in the more literal translations, like for instance the emphasized version, which translates that very clearly. So that Felix then had shown a measure of fairness to the apostle, because he realized that he was not really guilty of those charges. Now, we read in verse 24, and after certain days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, which was a Jewess, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ. Now, Drusilla is described here as a Jewess. She, in fact, was the daughter of King Herod Agrippa I, who was the Herod Agrippa of chapter 12 and verse 1. We'll speak a little more of him later. Now, her influence upon Felix was such as to cause him to consider the worship of the God of Israel a little further, to the extent where he invited the apostle to come before him and her in a private audience. Now, Drusilla herself was probably only curious, and perhaps it is suggested, in the manner of the growth of the Christian movement. She may have even have heard of the Apostle Paul. But whatever it was which induced her, her influence upon Felix was such as to give the apostle a further audience. Now, Paul seized the opportunity, as it were, with both hands, and he saw it as a means of further preaching the truth. And knowing what kind of man Felix was, and realizing now that he had been brought before virtually an adulteress, the apostle gave no reservations as to the things he spoke of. Now in verse 25 it says, "And as he reasoned of righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come, Felix trembled and answered, Go thy way for this time. When I have a convenient season, I will call for thee." Now we might ask ourselves why it was that the apostle immediately got onto the subjects of righteousness, temperance, and judgment to come. Well, probably the answer is this, that in verse 22 it says, "And when Felix heard these things, having more perfect knowledge of that way, he deferred them." Now Felix already had what is considered here a good understanding of the principles of truth, to the extent we believe that the apostle saw that Felix was responsible for his actions. And therefore immediately he launched into the matters of righteousness, temperance, and judgment. So that the apostle, in another place, in Romans 2, speaking of responsibility, he says, "They who obey not the truth, but obey unrighteousness, will receive indignation and wrath." Likewise, to the Corinthians, he said, we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. Those who are responsible to the principles of the truth, whether they accept them or whether they refuse them. And knowing the terror of the Lord, Paul said, we persuade men. And that was the spirit that he spoke to Felix and Drusilla on this occasion, because he knew that that man had some knowledge of the truth. Now righteousness involves the matters of justification, of forgiveness, and of baptism, the means of that forgiveness in the belief, the confidence, the acceptance of the sacrificial principles of the Lord. So he outlined to him, brethren and sisters, what we would style today the basic principles of the atonement. And Felix, having some knowledge of the truth, we believe, as his actions later showed, that he understood the point the apostle was getting at. Now, having established the responsibilities of the atonement, he then went on to talk about temperance, which is the restraint in action. which is the exercising of a repentant way of life. And temperance, brethren and sisters, is listed in Galatians chapter 5 as one of the fruits of the Spirit. So he's talking to Felix about walking in newness of life. And finally, realizing the issue of responsibility, he passed on to the judgment that was to come. Knowledge brings responsibility, and responsibility is answerable to the great judge. And with that, brethren and sisters, Felix trembled and answered, "Go thy way for this time. When I have a convenient season, I will call for thee." And there is an indication that Felix got the message. So much so that his guilt would have smote him within. And he felt most uncomfortable in front of the Apostle Paul. And he resorted to the usual way of escape, brethren and sisters, procrastination. "I will hear you of these things sometime later when I have a convenient season." And isn't that the answer that very often we get in the gospel proclamation fields of today? When we bring people to the point of reasoning with them, of getting them to acknowledge the truth of the Word of God, of getting them to see the hand of Yahweh working among the nations, the signs of the times, bringing them to a point where they should ought to be thinking, "Well, what should I be doing?" And then they tell us, "Well, we're too busy," or some other kind of procrastinated excuse. Now in verse 26, we read there of subsequent actions that Felix took. And this gives you some idea of the character of the man. He hoped also that money should have been given him of Paul, that he might loose him. Wherefore he sent for him the oftener and communed with him. So that after that little encounter with the apostle, as some time went on, as the pressure was released and the conscience became seared or hardened, then Felix, brethren and sisters, became overwhelmed with his covetous lust, and he began entertaining the apostle Paul, hoping to extract a bribe out of him to secure his release. Now, in that he did that, it would indicate to us that that man had quite a good knowledge of the way. He had sufficient knowledge, brethren and sisters, to realize that if the Apostle Paul was desperate to get out of prison, the Christians could have organized a collection and furnished Felix with that money. He knew that. Paul wouldn't have had any money at all to have paid him in the condition that he was, but Felix knew he could get it. And so this man was definitely responsible for the actions which he committed himself to. So then, the apostle, of course, never acceded to those requirements of Felix, and we read in verse 27 that after 2 years, Porcius Festus came into Felix's room, and Felix, willing to show the Jews a pleasure, left Paul bound. Now, in actual fact, during those 2 years, which were the years AD 58 to 60, during those 2 years, the disturbances, as we mentioned earlier, broke out between Jew and Gentile. And Felix was taken to Rome to answer charges which were laid against him by the Jews. However, the comment which Luke makes is that he left Paul in prison in order to show the Jews a favour that he might stand a better showing, and perhaps they may relax on their charges a little when he was facing Nero. Now, as it happened, it never turned out to his favour at all, and Felix was virtually vanquished from Nero's presence, and he became lost from history and into obscurity. And you know, that's teaching us, brethren and sisters, that here is a man who was responsible to the truth, who had every opportunity to accept it, who procrastinated on that decision, and now we see him lost into obscurity. And so Felix passes from the scene. And there we see one kind of Gentile ruler. He would represent, brethren and sisters, a rather unprincipled, unscrupulous kind of rulership. One which is seen to be guilty, one which is seen to be hardened against the truth, and shall ultimately be banished into obscurity, especially when we think of the rulers of today when the Lord returns. Now in chapter 25, we have a new procurator who comes onto the scene, this time Porcius Festus. Now Porcius Festus was appointed to the proconsulship in AD 60. His name means joyful. His name means joyful. And yet, you know, brethren and sisters, Porcius Festus died only 2 years later. And by implication, it would suggest that his kind of joyfulness was very short-lived. And therefore, here is a man who comes into Felix's room, and he is immediately faced with a situation, brethren and sisters, where there was internal hatred, where there was divisions and riots, if you like, between Jew and Gentile. And Porcius Festus had a tremendous job upon his hands, and his first work was to endeavour to retrieve some of the favour which Felix had lost with the Jews. Now Festus was a reasonable and a just man. His main objective, as I said, was to become familiar with the Jews, to try and retrieve some of the lost ground. He was a conscientious procurator or governor. And he was a man, of course, whilst he was conscientious, yet little, as we shall see, did he realise that the God of the man whom he was to sit in judgment upon was leading his destiny, inevitably, against his will. Now in verses 1 to 6, we read, "Now when Festus came into the province, after 3 days he ascended from Caesarea to Jerusalem. Then the high priest and the chief of the Jews informed him against Paul and besought him, and desired favour against him, that he would send for him to Jerusalem, laying wait in the way to kill him. But Festus answered, that Paul should be kept at Caesarea, and that he himself would depart shortly thither. Let them therefore, said he, which among you are able, go down with me and accuse this man, if there be any wickedness in him. And when he had tarried among them more than 10 days, he went down into Caesarea, and the next day, sitting on the judgment seat, commanded Paul to be brought." Now you reconstruct the drama, brethren and sisters, that is in these few verses. Festus comes into Felix's position. He's most anxious to receive the favour of the Jews. He wants to establish himself as a conscientious Roman governor. And he had only been in Caesarea for 3 days, and he found himself up in Jerusalem. That is how anxious he was to secure this favour of the Jews. Now the cunning devils knew that, and they pressed him into a corner. Because having moved up to Jerusalem, immediately they raised the issue of the Apostle Paul, and they morally pressed him into a corner to get him to agree to bring Paul back to Jerusalem. Now that man's integrity was right on the map, because in securing the favour of those Jews he could have brought Paul up. But his honesty, he had some principle in him, brethren and sisters, because he forbade it. And as he says a little later on, as we'll see, he told the Jews that Paul deserved, as a Roman citizen, a fair trial. And therefore he would not bring him up. And so he was prepared to show his firmness, his honesty, yet despite the fact he also desired the Jewish favour. So he acted with justice, with firmness, and with fairness. In verse 26 of his chapter, perhaps, we'll just have a quick look at that, which tells us the mind of the man. Speaking of the Apostle Paul, he says, "Of whom I have no certain thing to write unto my Lord, wherefore I have brought him forth before you, and especially before thee, O King Agrippa, that after examination, had, I might have somewhat to write. For it seemeth to me unreasonable to send a prisoner, and not withal to signify crimes laid against him." Actually, that wasn't quite the one that I was looking for, but never mind. We'll pick it up a little later on. But his mind was that this man deserved a fair trial. So taking up then the record from verse 7, it says, "And when he was come," this is the apostle before Festus, with his accusers there, "the Jews which came down from Jerusalem stood round about and laid many and grievous complaints against Paul, which they could not prove, while he answered for himself, neither against the law of the Jews, neither against the temple, nor yet against Caesar, have I offended anything at all." Now we notice, being conspicuous by its absence, that there was no lawyer involved in laying these charges. And as we might expect, it appears as though when the Jews came down, they laid many grievous charges, as Luke says, but they would have been charges, counter charges, and arguments. And it appears as though, again, there was this sort of tumultuous approach. So much so, brethren and sisters, that all Paul had to answer in defence of his integrity was that he had neither against the law of the Jews, neither against the temple, nor yet against Caesar, have I offended anything at all. That's simply all he had to say. And these Jews had virtually shown themselves for what they were before Festus. However, that left Festus in a quandary, because he had deduced, brethren and sisters, that Paul was not guilty of these charges. But he also saw that the Jewish hatred arose from some obtuse point of the law, which was beyond his understanding. So he was unable really of himself to get to the bottom of the case. And again, we see this idea of procrastination. But Festus, in verse 9, willing to do the Jews a pleasure, answered Paul and said, "Wilt thou go up to Jerusalem and there be judged of these things before me?" Now the man was not acting unjustly or dishonestly. He was in a perfect quandary. He knew that the issues had something to do with the law which he didn't understand. He also knew that the Jews wanted him to go to Jerusalem. And in his natural form of reasoning, he would have possibly thought, well, here is a man who is standing with integrity, a man who in his life had respect for the law, and yet he was hated for some reason. Why then should he not go to Jerusalem? For surely he should have confidence that he would win any trial which was laid against him. Yet, of course, he never took into account the injustice and the hatred, enmity that the Jews had for him. So he therefore, in procrastinating on his decision, not being able to stand up again and say this man is not guilty and acquit him and give him his freedom,
he then passes on the issue. And in fact, he passes the issue back to the Apostle Paul. For we read in verse 10, "Then said Paul, I stand at Caesar's judgment seat, where I ought to be judged. To the Jews have I done no wrong, as thou very well knowest. For if I be an offender, or have committed anything worthy of death, I refuse not to die. But if there be none of these things whereof these accuse me, no man may deliver me unto them. I appeal unto Caesar." Now the Apostle Paul seized the initiative and made the decision. Felix couldn't make the decision. Festus couldn't make the decision. So Paul took it in his own hands and he appealed to Caesar. Because you see, he knew, brethren and sisters, that if he went back to Jerusalem, they would lay in wait for him, that he would never see another trial, that they would kill him before he even got there. And should by some stroke of reason that he did get into the council and receive a trial, it would not be fair nor just. So in verse 12, Festus is rather taken back. Then Festus, when he had conferred with the council, answered, "Hast thou appealed unto Caesar? Unto Caesar thou shalt go." Now Festus realised that the apostle had taken the issue right out of his hands, because in appealing for a judgment before Caesar, it meant the case was now closed, that Paul had exercised an authority by reason of his Roman citizenship which transcended or exceeded the authority of Festus. And he was now bound to allow him to go to Rome. And furthermore, he could not send him to Jerusalem. The Jews also realised that the case was closed, and now the issue was to be resolved in Rome. Now the attention moves on to the third pair, or to the third form of Gentile rulership, although Festus is still to yet figure. But coming upon the scene, we have Agrippa and Bernice, as we read in verse 13, "And after certain days, King Agrippa and Bernice came unto Caesarea to salute Festus. And when they had been there many days, Festus declared Paul's cause unto the king, saying, There is a certain man left in bonds by Felix, about whom, when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and elders of the Jews informed me, desiring to have judgment against him. To whom I answered, It is not the manner of the Romans to deliver any man to die, before that he which is accused have the accusers face to face, and have license to answer for himself concerning the crime laid against him. Therefore, when they were come hither, without any delay on the morrow, I sat on the judgment seat and commanded the man to be brought forth, against whom, when the accusers stood up, they brought none accusation of such things as I supposed, but had certain questions against him of their own superstition, and of one Jesus, whom was dead, whom Paul affirmed to be alive. And because I doubted of such manner of questions, I asked him whether he would go to Jerusalem and there be judged of these matters. But when Paul had appealed to be reserved unto the hearing of Augustus, I commanded him to be kept till I might send him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said unto Festus, I would also hear the man myself. Tomorrow, said he, thou shalt hear him. Now in those verses, brethren and sisters, we have here the case now passed from Festus over to Agrippa and Bernice. So the spotlight, having focused on Felix, then on Festus, now comes upon Agrippa and Bernice. Well, Agrippa and Bernice are a brother and sister, and they are also the brother and sister of Drusilla, who was the wife of Felix. So you see, it's very much a family affair. Now, Agrippa and Bernice were the son and the daughter of King Herod Agrippa the First, which we mentioned. He is spoken of in Acts chapter 12. Now, he died in AD 44 as a result of worms consuming his body. Agrippa here, of whom we are reading, is Agrippa the Second, and he was only 17 years old at the death of his father. And Claudius deemed that he was not old enough to be promoted to his father's kingdom, and therefore it became a Roman province. In AD 48, however, 4 years later, King Agrippa, Agrippa the second, succeeded his uncle, who at the time was the king of Chalcis, which is in the north. Now, Chalcis, or the territory of Abilene, is actually just up north of Sidon. You've got up on the, what we call the Lebanese coast today, but up north you've got Tyre, and a little further up, Sidon. Well, just up slightly north of Sidon is this place called Chalcis, where Agrippa II succeeded his uncle. Now, having succeeded his uncle, later in AD 53, he was removed from Chalcis, and he was brought back and given the territory of Herod Philip and Lysanias, who ruled over the northern section of the land in Galilee and up towards Damascus. And it was Agrippa II who had his headquarters in Caesarea Philippi. So Agrippa now has come down from Caesarea Philippi, and he has come to visit Festus. Bernice. Well, Bernice was known in the history for her great beauty and her lax morals. She was married originally to one fellow called Marcus. That marriage broke up, and so she married her uncle, which doesn't show very much moral fibre, does it? Anyhow, she married her uncle, who at that time was the king of Chalcis. When he died in AD 48, and her brother succeeded the uncle, she joined with her brother, and she was viewed with some suspicion in relation to her brother. Later, as a means of sort of making a respectable veneer, she married the king of Pontus. Now, Pontus is the northernmost section of the territory of Asia Minor, which borders on the Black Sea. But needless to say, that cover-up marriage soon broke up. Subsequently, in time, she became the mistress of Vespasian, and after him, Titus. And then, finally, Titus disregarded her and abandoned her. So she was a woman who was known for her very lax morals, and yet, along with that, she did have courage, because she accompanied her brother on quite a number of occasions, when he had to officiate in the provinces. Now, this is the kind of people then that the apostle is finally meeting before: Agrippa and Bernice. Now, in verses 14 to 22, the case was passed on to Agrippa and Bernice, as we read. And we saw that these two are paying a courtesy call. Now, when we read on a little further, in verses 23 to 27, the case is introduced. So we read, "And on the morrow, when Agrippa was come, and Bernice, with great pomp, and was entered into the palace of hearing, with the chief captains and principal men of the city, at Festus's commandment, Paul was brought forth. And Festus said, King Agrippa, and all men which are here present with us, ye see this man about whom all the multitude of the Jews have dealt with me, both at Jerusalem and also here, crying that he ought not to live any longer. But when I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death, and that he himself had appealed to Augustus, I have determined to send him, of whom I have no certain thing to write unto my Lord. Wherefore I have brought him forth before you, and specially before thee, O King Agrippa, that after examination had, I might have somewhat to write, for it seemeth to me unreasonable to send a prisoner, and not withal to signify the crimes laid against him. Now, Festus saw this as a very good opportunity of trying to come to understand this problem with the Apostle Paul. Because, you see, King Agrippa, having the Jewish background, was familiar with all the ways of the law. So he was the ideal man to get to sit in judgment upon the case. Now, it was obvious that Agrippa had come down to Caesarea to pay a courtesy call, so as to indicate that he was perfectly in harmony and favour with the Roman rulership. So therefore, we see now that Festus lays out, so to speak, the red carpet, and with great pomp they took their positions in the judgment hall. Now, Agrippa's name means a wild horse, and Bernice, her name means bringer of victory. So we have the two combined together, giving us the idea of a militant, confident type of rulership. A wild horse and bringer of victory. So it conveys to our mind this idea of militancy and confidence, which of course we have that type of rulership in the world today. But there is a sad note of irony. These were the two children of Herod Agrippa I. They are arrayed here with tremendous pomp. You can imagine the glittering of the whole glory of the situation. Yet they were the two children of Herod Agrippa I, who in Acts chapter 12 slew James and hunted down Peter to kill him. And were it not for the intervention of the angel, he'd have killed Peter as well. But then, having passed down to Caesarea and standing up in the arena at Caesarea, this very city, and standing up in full glory, as Josephus said, in robes of silver, and noticing the reflecting light coming from that robes, the audience or the crowd around that arena hailed him as a god. And that man stood up and he accepted their eulogies, and with that, the record in Acts chapter 12 says that the angel smote him and he died with his body being consumed with worms. And that was the fate, brethren and sisters, of a man who opposed God, of a man who denied the righteousness of God. And here, in the very city, amidst the tinsel of human glory, his own son and daughter are to be seen to refuse the divine righteousness, and by implication their end will be like their father's. They will come to the grave. And so in verse 26, Agrippa and Bernice are to hear the apostle answer for his charges. Then Agrippa said unto Paul, "Thou art permitted to speak for thyself." Then Paul stretched forth the hand and answered for himself. Now in verses 2 to 3, the apostle speaks concerning his audience. He reminds them that they are familiar with the beliefs of the Jews, and therefore what is to follow they will understand. So he says, "I think myself happy, King Agrippa, because I shall answer for myself this day before thee, touching all things whereof I am accused of the Jews, especially because I know thee to be expert in all customs and questions which are among the Jews. Wherefore I beseech thee to hear me patiently." So he begins his case on that note. In verses 4 to 5, Paul outlines that he was brought up with a bias toward Judaism. He says, "My manner of life from my youth, which was at the first among mine own nation at Jerusalem, know all the Jews, which knew me from the beginning, if they would testify, that after the most straitest sect of our religion, I lived a Pharisee." Now in verses 6 to 7, he shows that he still endorses the national hope. He says, "And now I stand and am judged for the hope of the promise made of God unto our fathers, unto which promise our 12 tribes, instantly serving God day and night, hope to come. For which hope's sake, King Agrippa, I am accused of the Jews." Now in verse 8, he brings to the light the issue of the resurrection. He says that by implication, the national hope involves the resurrection. So why dispute a living Christ? Why should it be thought a thing incredible with you that God should raise the dead? I verily thought within myself that I ought to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth, which thing I also did in Jerusalem. And many of the saints did I shut up in prison, having received authority from the chief priests. And when they were put to death, I gave my voice against them. And I punished them oft in every synagogue and compelled them to blaspheme. And being exceedingly mad against them, I persecuted them even unto strange cities. Whereupon, as I went to Damascus with authority and commission from the chief priests, at midday, O king, I saw in the way a light from heaven, above the brightness of the sun, shining round about me and them which journeyed with me. And when we were all fallen to the earth, I heard a voice speaking unto me, saying in the Hebrew tongue, Saul, Saul, why persecutest thou me? It is hard for thee to kick against the pricks. And I said, Who art thou, Lord? And he said, I am Jesus whom thou persecutest. But rise and stand upon thy feet, for I have appeared unto thee for this purpose, to make thee a minister and a witness, both of these things which thou hast seen, and of those things in the which I will appear unto thee, delivering thee from the people and from the Gentiles, unto whom now I send thee, to open their eyes, and to turn them from darkness to light, and from the power of Satan unto God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins, and inheritance among them which are sanctified by faith that is in me. So in those verses, the Apostle Paul then logically progressed his theme. He first of all pointed out that his beliefs were the national hope. The national hope was that of the law and the prophets. They spoke about the resurrection of the dead. Therefore, why should one disbelieve the resurrection of Jesus? For then he went on to say, I saw him myself, and it was he who commissioned me to go forth to the Gentiles and turn them from darkness to light. And he seized upon those words, brethren and sisters, to touch the conscience of Agrippa, because he too was familiar with all the customs of the law and of the prophets. So in verses 19 to 21, the apostle then continues to show that his preaching was designed to turn men to God. Whereupon, O King Agrippa, I was not disobedient unto the heavenly vision, but showed first unto them of Damascus, and at Jerusalem, and throughout all the coasts of Judea, and then to the Gentiles, that they should repent and turn to God and do works meet for repentance. For these causes the Jews caught me in the temple and went about to kill me. Now in verses 22 to 23, he then continues to show that his preaching, which he went forth with, comprised of an exposition of the law and the prophets, who simply spoke of the resurrection. He says, Having therefore obtained help of God, I continue unto this day witnessing both to small and great, saying none other things than those which the prophets and Moses did say should come, that Christ should suffer, and that he should be the first that should rise from the dead, and should show light unto the people and to the Gentiles. And at that point, brethren and sisters, Festus burst out with uncontrolled emotion. And as he thus spake in verse 24 for himself, Festus said with a loud voice, Paul, thou art beside thyself. Much learning doth make thee mad. But he said, I am not mad, most noble Festus, but speak forth the words of truth and soberness. For the king knoweth of these things, before whom also I speak freely. For I am persuaded that none of these things are hidden from him, for this thing was not done in a corner. Now with that, the whole issue was coming to a head. Festus had been sitting back, and he was listening to this reasoned address. He had perceived in times before of the integrity of the apostle, so that he saw that here was a man who was intelligent. Here was a man who was well educated. Here was a man who had many things that could run for him in life. And having come to that point, he said, look, Paul, you are a man. By reason of your study, by reason of your belief, why give up all those things which could be yours for a man who was slain as a criminal, and you say he was raised? That was the thoughts of Felix. He couldn't understand why this man should sacrifice the things of his life for the things that he believed, for the Lord Jesus Christ. And so Festus goes down on record as the man who charged the Apostle Paul with madness. He couldn't understand the wisdom of God. And he, brethren and sisters, speaks to us of that kind of person of which the Apostle spoke of in Corinthians. The wise of this world, who look upon the things of God as foolishness. And that's how the world looks upon us, brothers and sisters, foolish, because we give up many of the so-called software and luxuries of the world in order to serve one who was crucified but raised again. So Festus is a man who, whilst he is honest, who, whilst he had an integrity that could be admired, yet he was a man, brothers and sisters, who was branded with the philosophy of the world, a philosophy which could not permit his mind to penetrate spiritual things, and therefore he remained within his sins. Now in verse 28, the apostle had really put Agrippa on the map, because he had pointed out that Agrippa knew full well that the law and the prophets testified of the suffering and of the resurrection of Christ, and that furthermore, that suffering, that execution, and finally resurrection was not done in a corner. And Agrippa knew that, and being most embarrassed, brethren and sisters, pressed out of extreme embarrassment, Agrippa replied in verse 28, then Agrippa said unto Paul, almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian. And Paul said, I would to God that not only thou, but also all that hear me this day, were both almost and altogether such as I am, except these bonds. Now Agrippa, you see, was in a real spot, because it was essential to him that he maintained his integrity and favour with the Jews. It could not be seen that he would support Paul in front of Jews. So therefore he had to avoid supporting the apostle. Whereas on the other hand, if he admitted to the resurrection of the dead, the Romans, Festus would have looked upon him as being as mad as Paul. So he was caught between two. What could he do, brothers and sisters, but simply say, almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian? But obviously it was said with a certain amount of high-mindedness to protect one's pride and so-called integrity. However, he was facing a master tactician, and in a stroke of genius, the Apostle Paul seized upon those words of Agrippa and turned them upon him as a weapon of utter humiliation, because he took the opportunity to say that he would not only have Agrippa and Bernice, He would have all those present to be like him, except not being in bonds. Now look at the irony of that. Amidst all this great pomp, a man and a woman, a brother and a sister whose father was smitten with wounds because he had followed the same order of thinking. And yet here was another man who in the eyes of the world was totally desolate. He was a prisoner. There was no glory about him. Yet the apostle could later write to the Corinthians, in the 2 Corinthians 4, could later write that the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are unseen are eternal. And they are the things which the apostle wished they could all be partakers of, excepting to bear his bonds. And so in verses 30 to 32, the final judgment was proclaimed. And we read there, "And when they were gone aside, they talked between themselves, saying, This man doeth nothing worthy of death or bonds. Then said Agrippa unto Festus, This man might have been set at liberty if he had not appealed unto Caesar." And so the proceedings were abruptly terminated. And Agrippa, who had been emotionally stirred, brethren and sisters, found himself in the witness box standing trial, and he resented very much the fact that he was being interrogated by a suspected criminal. And therefore, he immediately or promptly terminated the proceedings. However, when they adjourned into a private room, his integrity allowed him to confess that he could find nothing wrong with Paul, that he was not guilty of the charges laid against him. And yet we also see, brethren and sisters, that despite the fact that he said that he ought to be set at liberty, there was nothing he could do about it. Because Paul had appealed to Caesar, he had to go to Rome, and therefore Agrippa had no power over the case. And so we have looked upon then these three forms of Gentile rulership. Felix, who was a licentious, unprincipled man, who ruled as a king with the temperament of a slave. Festus, who was a noble man, who exercised wisdom and fairness and justice. Yet he was immersed in the wisdom of the world, which was like living in trespass and sin. He was dead in that respect. And Agrippa, the militant, the confident, who refused the hope of glory, who could say almost, "Thou persuadest me to be a Christian." And he procrastinated and he refused that, brethren and sisters. And all three are found to stand before the apostle in weakness, not being able to match the prestige and the brilliance and the integrity of the apostle, and all three feeling the guilt of themselves smiting them within, and each of them would have been very, very relieved to have seen the last of the apostle Paul. And so in those chapters, brethren and sisters, when we can scan them across as we have done, we therefore see really why they are set in this context in the Acts, to show us the reaction of these Gentile principalities to the influence of the truth. And in the time to come, brethren and sisters, when the greater than Paul, when the Lord Jesus Christ himself, he who has supreme authority, when he returns, brethren and sisters, these Gentile powers shall be seen for what they are, and then they shall receive their just reward. Now, God willing, in our next class, we will complete our studies upon the Acts of the Apostles. And we will consider, under the theme, the Ecclesia in the times of the Gentiles, in their voyage of life, we will cover across the last two chapters, chapters 27 and 28.